When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Welcome to The Times. To find out more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Every goal, every game, everywhere. The Times and the Sunday Times, now with Goals.
Hello and welcome to The Game, the football podcast from The Times. I'm Gabriel Marcotti, and in the studio this week, I am joined by the excellent Alison Rudd and the budding meteorologist, James Scowcroft. Coming up, we'll be talking through the Northeast Derby, chatting some Thierry Henry, as well as the usual quick hits. But first, let's focus on Anfield.
24 for Liverpool as Lallana drives it in. And Skirtle has scored in the seventh minute of stoppage time. Martin Skirtle, the man who scored two in the first 10 minutes against Arsenal in their demolition here in February, has struck very late. And the 10 men have salvaged the draw deep into added time.
Okay, so I know not everybody here is Brendan Rodgers' biggest fan, but I thought he completely destroyed Arsenal tactically and Liverpool. I mean, obviously the numbers bear that out. I think it's the lowest ever possession in the Wenger era. 27 shots on goal. James?
I think it was the best I've seen Liverpool play this season. I know they had a fantastic result at Tottenham, but I just thought it was a little bit of Liverpool of last year, wasn't it? They have a lot of energy. You can say tactically, but I thought one team looked laboured and the other team looked vibrant, lots of energy, and obviously had a lot of criticism, hasn't he, Brendan Rodgers and the team, and you could almost just see yesterday it was there was a little bit of aggression in their right. Performance.
What did he? Obviously he changed or he employed the system. Can you tell us tactically what he did that was different and why it worked?
He sort of outnumbered the four versus the three in midfield, didn't he? Now, there's arguments to say that if the wide players from Arsenal drop back in, it's then five versus four. You can go on about tactics. But I just think they pressed Arsenal. I think they moved the ball quicker than what they usually did. And I think a few players had a point to prove.
Alison, is this some kind of A, vindication for Rodgers, B, a system that can work longer term?
I really genuinely thought there were two poor teams out there and Arsenal were the...
You're giving the thumbs up, James. And obviously, nobody. I need to report this because there are no cameras here. Okay, so you were not impressed by Liverpool.
The reason I say that is I accept of all the performances this season, this was one of the better performances by Liverpool, and there was definitely they definitely were moving the ball quicker, and there was a bit more confidence on the ball than there has been. But Arsenal was so poor. It just seemed to me slightly bizarre that whenever they did string a few passes together, which wasn't very often, they immediately looked like they were going to score. And given how little possession they had and how few shots they had, the fact they scored twice is still a worrying trend from a Liverpool point of view. And I just felt, and if, given that Liverpool were at home, the crowd were fantastic, they were definitely trying to replicate the annihilation of Arsenal from last season. And they were really going for that early 20-minute pulsating slog at them. That was a good tactic to try and sort of remind the Arsenal players, you know, you had an awful time last season, and they did seem a bit jittery. But given all that, you know, the fact that Liverpool still couldn't get 3 points from probably one of the poorest right. Arsenal performances I've seen is, you know, I don't think that isn't something that you can then come out and say, I think we might get top four out of that
That's a criticism of Rodgers and the things he says when he opens his mouth, which is different and which we'll get to. But in terms of the way they played, what struck me, and they highlighted this on Match of the Day, although, you know, I think anybody who saw it on TV would have noticed this, is they had Ollie Kay in our paper called a 3-4-2-1 system, but it was basically a back three Markovic and Henderson wide as wingbacks, if you will. And then you kind of had this box with Gerrard and Lucas at the back and Coutinho and Lallana at the top of it. They were up against Cazorla, Oxlade-Chamberlain, and poor Flamini stuck in between Coutinho and Lallana, and there was no reaction to it. I found this really, really bizarre from Wenger's perspective, that he somehow thought that Flamini could look after two guys by himself. And James, when you see that happening, and maybe Wenger wasn't expecting them to line up this way, but surely you expect an adjustment on the pitch. I mean, you talked before about the wingers tucking in and helping out. Well, do you have any explanation?
Well, I think you've half explained it yourself, Gab. I think Wenger asked us it early, and you have to change. You know, okay, you know, Liverpool are a bit of a mixed bag every week. You don't know the formation or the team lineup, but you've got 90 minutes to adjust. And, you know, he hasn't got to make wholesale changes. He's just got to get the midfield three very, very narrow. Like Phil Neville highlighted on Match of the Day last night, make them very compact and then use the two wide players as your overload and get those to come in and they can break out. But, you know, like I say, they got caught in no man's land, Arsenal. They didn't press the ball. They stood off and, you know, allowed Liverpool to dominate. And I'm not one for stats, but 36% possession from Arsenal, the lowest for 10 years, says it all.
It was the lowest since they've started keeping recording these numbers for Arsenal. And what's weird is when you have, as you said, when you have such little possession, you expect that it's because the team is sitting back and trying to hit on the break. But Arsenal weren't even doing that. If you look at the positions, Alexis Sanchez I'm blanking on the other winger. Help me.
Welbeck.
And Danny Welbeck, yes.
No wonder you don't remember. It was the quietest he's been since he joined Arsenal, in fact.
Well, because those guys were sort of standing there waiting for service, which never came. Which I thought, again, was pretty
remarkable.
And another
bizarre, well, there were quite a lot of bizarre things going on in that match. Another one was, if you sort of sat and watched Arsenal, you found yourself getting slightly obsessed with where Giroud was playing. Why is he playing left? Oh, is he playing right? Oh, he's central now. Where is he? Why is he? We know he so clearly should be the fulcrum, the guy trying to hold the ball up and bring the wide players into play. It was as though there was some sort of random Liverpool are a mess, or just have fun issued to them before kickoff, as opposed to a really solid
I think maybe Arsene Wenger, if you looked at it, especially if you play three at the back, you're supposed to tactically push your three right on, so you're playing three against three, and maybe Arsene Wenger and Arsenal thought, well, if we play high up the pitch, we can get Joy one-on-one. There's gaps in the Liverpool defence. They are very, very leaky at the moment, but, you know, the consequences of that is that they got dominated in midfield.
I wanted to start with that and maybe some praise for Brendan Rodgers, because you made a face at Arsenal, but otherwise, if we look at all four goals, there was some pretty putrid defending of the kind you just, and mistakes that to me highlight. I mean, you call them two bad teams, and to be fair, I think these are two teams who really defended very, very badly. On Coutinho's goal, which he took extremely well, I was struck by the fact that obviously Debuchy has to deputize at center back. Supposedly he likes Debuchy now as an emergency center back more than Callum Chambers. It's something I don't really get. I mean, I think they both equally struggle as central defenders because they're not central defenders and they have never played central defense. But did you feel Debuchy could have could or should have gotten tighter to Coutinho there? I mean, does a little shimmy, but he defended it to me like he looked to me like a right back jockeying his opponent on the wing rather than somebody saying, oh, we're in a danger zone here, this guy could shoot.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree with that assessment. I mean, last season when Arsenal played well, it was always because they had that triangle of Chesney, Mertesacker and Koscielny, and it started to really function as one of the best of that sort of triangle of defence of any of the Premier League teams, and they always built from that. And it is not to Wenger's credit that when that is disrupted, it the whole back line falls apart. It shouldn't be so destructive on a team when one member of that trio is out. And you know, I don't know that Koscielny in isolation is such a brilliant defender, but when he's there, when it's those three, Arsenal just play so much better, and the rest of the team have confidence from it. So I'm not going to. I don't particularly want to pick on Debuchy, because I think apart from that, he played okay. It's just
I think Koscielny would have got tighter,
you,
though, wouldn't
he? With Mertesacker, it doesn't.
Well, it's certainly any central defender you would expect from
them. Well, you would do, yeah.
Because there's help behind. It just seemed like it was almost like an unnatural defensive action for him. The equalizer, which came almost straight away. First of all, was there a foul from Debushi on Skrtel? And if there wasn't a foul, how does somebody who's 5 inches taller and heavier and is a center back like Skrtel allow Debushi to just, who's not a great header of the ball, to go and beat him like that? James, you've been in those situations. Is it a switch off? Does he not expect Debushi to even be able to challenge him?
That is the case. I think it's one of those that you just sort of lose concentration, don't you? I think sometimes when you're playing against maybe a Giroud, or you've got that concentration because you know that you've got to be on top of your game every time the ball comes, I think it's just, he just turns off. He underestimates it, really. And, you know, like I say, it's a big mistake.
Ollie made the point there that on that sequence, Liverpool allowed Arsenal to win basically 3 headers in the box, with Mertesacker, which you can understand because he's 9 feet tall, but then Flamini as well, and then Debushi. I mean, there's an issue with second balls.
Yeah, well, Arsenal do really well because they keep it alive, don't they? They keep the pressure. It's always, when I was marking at set pieces, you're always told to get touch tight. So without fouling, without grabbing someone's shirt, you knew where your man was. And I think Skrtel there just gets wrong side and loses his man. I think ball watching is probably the common phrase there, but you know, these are key moments. Yeah, we talk about possession and things in and how people play in midfield and keeping, but you know, football's all about what you do in both penalty boxes to a certain extent, isn't it? And set pieces are massive.
Alisson, the third goal in the game, Arsenal's second. Again, I don't want to pick on Liverpool's defenders, but it's that 1-2 from Giroud to Cazorla. Nobody goes to shut Cazorla down. And then when it's obvious he's going to cross the ball, there's 3 of them in there, and all of them sort of run towards the goal line as if they're going to cut out the cross, not realizing that there's a large Frenchman in a yellow shirt just behind them. And it seems so easy. It's almost like they were all moving away from Giroud.
Yeah.
I mean, you're looking at me mystified, but I mean,
I'm not going to be able to defend that, am I? I'm not going to be able to say that was, you know, but the correct thing to do.
I'm not suggesting that, but is it 3 players all making bad decisions at once? Is it one guy not calling them? Is it because they have to get used to playing in a back 3? From what I thought,
it's the same old argument. You've got to get tight. Doesn't matter if you're playing back 3, 4, 5, whatever.
Right, but from what I was taught, it is normally one of the 3, usually the one furthest away from the ball, who has the best sight line, effectively becomes almost like a sweeper or a defensive organizer.
But we're not talking on the halfway line here. We're talking on the edge of the box, aren't we? Giroud comes off. He's got acres of space. But plays a 1-2.
Right, and then at that point, I would have expected, obviously somebody has to go and try to get in the way of Cazorla's cross, even though it's kind of... Yeah. But then you still have 2 people there. One of them goes to help out, and the other one notices where Giroud is. Should there have been a shout? Is that what normally happens, or should they know ahead of time what they're going to do? Or
I think it's you're there to defend, and this is what you should be working on the training ground day in, day out, and a lot of teams are. I think if that's John Terry, for example, he's tight to Giroud, so he makes it very, very hard for the ball to come into his feet and him to lay the ball off, so he probably lays it backwards. And if the ball does go out wide, he then gets tight to him, so if it does come into the box, his first is on the front foot.
But it was also a very laboured 1-2, so there's no excuse.
It was 2 miles an hour.
Exactly, so it wasn't like the defence
didn't have
time to adjust to what was happening. It was overhit. Cazorla seemed to take an age to get to it because it was overhit, and it was all very telegraphed what was going to happen. So it makes the mistakes even more bizarre. But Gab, what I would say was, I suspect Liverpool aren't really playing 3 at the back to improve their defence. They're playing 3 at the back because it means that they can feel more like an attacking team. I don't feel like 3 at the back is seen as the solution to Liverpool's defensive anxieties in recent months. It's just the pain they're feeling in the backroom staff is that Liverpool have lost the zest and passion to their aggressiveness to the way they play, and they've decided if they play 3 at the back, it frees up more players to play an attacking role. It's not meant to be a a tonic for their defensive woes.
But they're shipping in goals, Alison, aren't they?
Well, they're still shipping in goals, whether they play three at the back or not.
Exactly. So that's a mentality, isn't it? Where, more than a tactical thing.
So they're going back to the, well, let's just try and score more than we let in. And we're more likely to do that if we play three at the back. Would you agree?
Well, I would do. But if you're going to see two or three goals, it's very, very hard in a Premiership against good opposition to score, you know, three or four goals to win a game of football. And this is their Achilles heel. Last year they had the players that could score three or four goals. They haven't got it now. So what you've got to do, you've got to tighten up. If they tighten up at the back yesterday, they win the game.
Yeah, or if they convert some of the chances. I think they were a little bit unlucky earlier with some of the chances. I mean, they might have won this 4-2, 4-3. As it happened, it took that late equaliser from Skrtel. And I saw this issue coming up again, zonal marking, non-zonal marking, and whatever else. I'm hoping, James, you coach kids, you defended on set pieces. Presumably you had people telling you how to organize set pieces. Can you walk us through, because it looked to me like Arsenal were marking zonally, and it's a pretty familiar way that they do this. They have somebody on either post, although I think it was Gibbs on the near post who then peeled away, and that's ultimately where Skrtel's header went. They had Mertesacker in the middle. They had Chambers to his right, and I think it might have been Welbeck to his left. One of the arguments against zonal marking is this business with attacking the ball, and how if you mark man-to-man, you can run with your guy, you're touch tight to him, you can put him off from jumping. In this situation, is that a fair criticism? You see Skrtel all the way out there, and he's got all the time to run in, pick his spot, and jump, and head the ball. Is that what happened here?
It's exactly what happened, Gab, and you're spot on. What happens, you've got somebody who's running 4 or 5 yards, attacking the ball against someone who's got a standing jump. So it's only going to be one winner.
What I would suggest here, though, is... Because last night, and in general, they made so much about the fact that Mertesacker shrinks away like a little violet. In reality, and then that was weird, and obviously if he stands up, he's so big, maybe he gets in the way of the ball and whatever else. I'm not exonerating Mertesacker. But if you look, it's Chambers who goes and runs out and tries to meet it. So I'm giving Wenger the benefit of doubt here, but it looks to me like he had allowed for something like this to happen, and he had a plan. It's just that it didn't work.
I think the thing is that the key to it, and I see managers lose goals week in, week out from zonal marking, and they don't change it, and there's a lot of teams that do it, a lot of teams. You know, I worked under Harold Wilkinson for a small time and saw him put a presentation on zonal marking and how good it was and the reasons why to do it. It's just never been for me at all. I like a player that's got the responsibility, and they're all told before the game, this is the man that you are marking. This is what he's good at. This is where the areas he likes to attack the ball. You can get up against him, so you can stop him from getting a run and jump. You can probably try and keep him out of the danger zone as well. But you know that it's you versus him. And I think that's... When you're given no responsibility, sometimes you can get distracted. You can... There's other things that can come across. And we was always told, and a very good coach who taught me about set pieces actually was... learnt from the Wimbledon crazy days, who were very good, Alan Cork. And again, with zonal marking, what he did is he picked person after person. He said, right, you make your run across him, you make your run across him, you make, and what you're doing, you're interfering players. So if someone runs across you, you're going to come out of your position. Okay, so that will then leave another gap in behind, and you will get success. And every time we played a team in zonal marking, we did this. Everyone was given an area to run into, and we just had success all the time.
So... I think the counter argument to that would
you
be
you can do both, Gav. You can actually mark and zonal mark. If you get it,
yeah,
marked.
No.
Tony Pulis did it well last year, and they only scored Palace letting one free kick set piece. It was against Liverpool last way of the season. Listen, if you get Tony Pulis there, you don't concede goals.
Again, I think this Arsenal performance was an aberration because of the way it unfolded, and Liverpool deserved the 3 points.
Do you think both teams are getting the top four?
Sorry?
Do you think both teams will finish in the top four?
If they play like this, definitely not. Until very recently, I would have said Arsenal were definitely going top four. Now, I'm not so sure, just simply because this was just such a weird performance.
And Sunderland might be able to play the way out of trouble here. It's Adam Johnson. Good advantage play by referee Taylor. Still Johnson makes his way forward. Danger for Newcastle as Fletcher has it now. Back for Buckley. He's pulled it back for Johnson! Adam Johnson surely wins it in the 90th minute for Sunderland.
All right, let's move on to the Great North East, Newcastle and Sunderland. Sunderland, was it now? This is the fourth win in a row in this fixture.
Yep.
Again, I'll start with you, James, because you had the privilege of playing in a very heated derby situation. Ipswich and Norwich, of course. It does seem to matter a lot to people.
It does, yeah.
But does it? Obviously, that's in East Anglia, which is sort of, how can I say this nicely? Slightly cut off from.
Just say what you're thinking.
All right, what I'm thinking is that a little bit like the Northeast, it's a little bit cut off from the London, Birmingham, Manchester axis, and a little bit sort of peripheral to the general media obsession in this country, which tends to focus.
People like you don't really care, so you break it down.
You could put it that way. No, but.
But that's what makes it more intense.
That is what makes it more intense.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
Keep your cheese in the sink.
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no. So yes. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
Right?
Yeah, exactly, yeah. It's the Ipswich Norwich one's a strange one because they're actually 44 miles apart. You know, it's not like.
But there's nothing in between, so.
There's a lot in between.
Okay, natural. Pretty.
It feels. See what you're going to eat tonight, it will be grown. That's what's in between. That's what comes off the fields and will be put on your plate.
Should we play the Archers music now?
Okay, so you played in this rural derby.
The old farm.
It feels strange for me because I'm obviously not from the Northeast. I haven't spent much time there, although I have been there. It just seems to me that this is one of those things, and it sounds trite and corny, but it really is huge. And going forward, if these two teams aren't going to get relegated and they're not going to, you know, get into Europe regularly, this is what you circle on your calendar when you're not calling for Alan Pardew to be sacked.
Yeah, it's a big game, and I think if ever you go on YouTube or go on YouTube and type in Newcastle Sunderland fans, you'll see both sets of fans go into the game, and you'll see the passion and a rivalry, and obviously overspill sometimes. But I think it's just a tradition that's passed down, and people grow up, you know, with this, probably hatred is the right word, to, you know, the team that they hate most. And it is, speaking from an Ipswich Norwich point of view, it is probably the one fixture that comes out in July or June when the fixtures come out that they look forward to the most. It's usually the bigger crowd. The build-up is far bigger than any other one. And this is a prime example. You know, it's a massive derby, the Newcastle-Sunderland one.
It just struck me that clearly this game is so important, and you could tell that Pardew wanted to win it so much, and he took a gamble. He took a gamble in the second half, and you could see Newcastle attacking, and is it as simple as that? He just gambled too much, maybe gambled the right amount, but probability decreed that Sunderland would nick a goal. Is that what happened?
Well, if you look at the game could have ended up 5-5 for the chances in the game, and I think you're right. I think Alan Pardew was desperate to win it. I think they overcommitted and paid a heavy price, and hindsight's a wonderful thing, but I'm sure this morning they'll be thinking, should I have done that?
It's not something you can blame for, though.
No, I don't. I think Newcastle
from a risk reward perspective.
Yeah, exactly, and I think Newcastle were unlucky. I don't think they deserve to lose it, but I think sometimes you have to get to a point in a game, and with 5 minutes to go, with a game so stretched, you have to think we've done our best here. We're not going to win, but what we make sure we do, we don't get beat.
Yeah, but you're right to raise the fact that it is a different sort of match and an emotional match, because you know maybe the sensible thing to do was to settle for the draw, but that isn't really an option in that sort of match, is it? In a way, I think he probably gets off from the supporters' point of view, giving it a go. They're happier that he did that than played pragmatically, because that would imply that he didn't care.
But yeah, and I think also in Pardew's position, what's one more point in the table going to do for you? You know, you're as I said, like, you will finish the season in mid-table. But the benefits of getting that monkey off your back, of winning the derby, you could parlay that and hopefully roll over the enthusiasm into doing something useful. Whereas point or defeat, I don't think makes too much of a difference for him.
No, but see, I don't know. This is a weird one because I saw Pardew midweek after the defeat at Spurs in the Capital One Cup. He said, you know, it would be unacceptable. Pardew, it would be unacceptable to lose a fourth derby in a row. And he wasn't really being asked about it. He was hyping it up himself. And I just don't feel there's any seismic repercussions from this defeat. Maybe because he's got all those good results in the bank after that awful start.
I think it puts a little bit more pressure on the next derby game. Do you not think this all of a sudden we've won the last four in a row? And I think it just adds pressure. He's going to win a game of football. I don't think you can criticise a man. He's a nice man, isn't he, Alan Pardew?
A lot of people seem to really like him. As promised, in our debate this week, we're going to reflect on Thierry Henry, who retired. Announced his retirement last week to go and become a pundit on Sky. But Alison, I want to start with you and the piece you wrote at the end of last week. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
What can I tell people they don't already know about Thierry Henry?
Well, you wrote a whole,
asked to write an appreciation of him from a personal point of view.
Can you stop flipping the papers, pages on the newspaper?
Yeah, that's very rude. I'll just tell everyone James Gerdon is not looking like he cares.
With our debate.
There's nothing in the paper about Thierry today.
I'm looking up your thing. I'm sorry.
It's not in the paper.
It's not.
And ideally, presumably you played against him at some point.
I did, yes.
So, yeah, so we're looking for that sort of thing.
Well, I shall wait for you to ask me a question.
I will do. Please, Alison, continue.
I was asked to write a personal appreciation of Thierry Henry. We all know his stats. And I suppose if you were just looking at stats, maybe he isn't the greatest Premier League player of all time. I mean, an argument to be made for Frank Lampard because he's going to outscore him, and from midfield, which is quite a feat. But anyway, in terms of sheer beauty, Thierry is up there. I mean, you can't do better really than just sort of watch how he played, but to try and put it into words, he did have that ability, which I think the very best players have, certainly the ones I admire the most. He's like he's operating in a different time zone. So he would receive the ball and... Yeah, he's capable of volleying, capable of taking a really good free kick. But the best bits of Thierry Henry is when he decides where he's going to shift. He shifts the ball into space, and always defenders always look like, oh my goodness, I didn't know that space existed. Why is he putting the ball there? It was as though he had sort of an extra angle or a different dimension to the game. He just saw it slightly differently. He saw space where the other people didn't see it, and then he'd glide through and score. And there's just... I don't know if you learn that or it's just... It probably is partly simply because he's converted from being a winger to a striker, and maybe that's how he saw... That's why he saw the pitch differently from a striker's point of view. He just saw more space to be in. Anyway, that's what I loved most about him, was that he sort of created a time-space dimension that a lot of defenders simply couldn't cope with.
You might say that he learned how to bend time and space.
Indeed, I'll go that far,
Gab. The dimensions to his will. You brought up the aesthetic side of it, which is obviously very important because ultimately we watch great players and we remember how they looked, how they did something, you know, and it's not always just sort of grace and beauty. It can also be power. I mean, I have a Duncan Ferguson fetish myself, and seeing this sort of enormous man just violently score a goal or whatever, to me that's special too. But what struck me about Henry was that he had this incredible production to go with the aesthetic side of things, the scoring records for a historic club like Arsenal. One game stands out, and I don't mean to upset you with this because I think your club allegiances are well known, but for me there was that remarkable game against Liverpool, and you may have
blanked it from memory,
but as I recall, it was one of those seasons where sort of everything was crumbling for Arsenal. They'd just been knocked out of the Champions League or the FA Cup or something, and I think they were 2-0 down, and it was all just falling apart. And then he just took the game over, and I think he scored a hat trick. He had these leadership qualities, these qualities of taking responsibility onto himself that great players have.
Yeah, that
you
is.
You really have blanked that game from
your
memory.
Yeah, I have a bit. I know, I mean, I think he often played well against Liverpool from memory. And Liverpool players are always very generous in their praise of him. I think that's another yardstick, in fact, is that even when he might have dismantled a team, when you interviewed the players afterwards, they were so generous in their praise of him. It's almost like it didn't matter if you were taken apart by Thierry Henry because he was exceptional. And I think that's part, if you make a list of how you judge the greatness of a player, that's a criteria, definitely, the way that opposition talk about you afterwards. It's like, you don't mind that he might take the game by the scruff of the neck and apply beauty, because who else is going to do that? There's no shame in it at all.
James, you played against him. What was it like? You've got a rich trove of anecdotes.
Did he swear violently at you and kick you?
No, he's probably the most friendliest person. I came on the pitch. I played the last game when they went unbeatable. It was Leicester. Last game of the season, where their famous invincible season. And we were actually winning 1-0 with about 25 minutes to go.
And then you decided to let them set the record.
Yeah, exactly. And I actually saw him do this a couple of times, actually. I played for Ipswich, where he'd come on as a sub, and he was just started to get going. And he was one of these players that actually at times played within himself, but he could go to a level. When I say playing within himself, he was still the best player on the pitch, but he could go to a level where he could just think, right, I'm going to get the game by the scruff of the neck here. I'm going to turn a sort of a defeat into a win. And he did it that day. And I can remember Arsene Wenger coming to the sideline and saying, hey, Thierry, we need more from you, blah, blah, blah. And he was just swearing around. And all of a sudden, he went up two or three gears and wow.
So you heard Wenger shout that too?
I've heard him say that twice. Come on, Thierry, we need more from you. You know.
And then what? A switch flicked and he just did it?
Yeah. And I can remember him coming. He'd come on as a sub for Arsenal. For Ipswich, and this was 2000, I think it was, and he got the winner, and he'd been, I think he was actually dropped, and he was just as this sort of spell when he first came to Arsenal, because he didn't set the world alight, did he, when he first came? It took him a while to get going, but he came on that day and he was something else. He was, you know, it was quite an even game. He had a very good Ipswich side at the time, and he came on, and it was just like the big kid in the playground who's just better and can just get the ball, go around everybody else and score. And he come on and he scored the winning goal and just totally changed the game. But one thing, he was very, very good, and probably people haven't picked this up, and I've watched all the highlights of some of his goals. He was really good at dead ball free kicks. I saw him at Filbert Street one night, hit a free kick. He actually hit the post, and he must have been 35, 38 yards out, and he's hit this ball. And I'm thinking, sure, you're not going to shoot from there. And I've never seen someone hit a sweeter dead ball free kick than what he did that night.
Did your did the managers you played for, did they sort of prepare a special, like, tailor-made approach? Because he did that thing, especially in the last few years he was here, where, you know, he'd sort of be on the shoulder of the last defender and then sort of run offside and then run back onside.
Yeah. Well, what he'd float around. He wouldn't really play up and up as a sort of a number nine centre forward. He'd float into different positions. And I think, going back to Alisson's point, where he'd shift the ball into space. And the reason he did do that is because defenders had to drop off, so you had to give him space in front. And if you watch several of his goals, he gets the ball, he turns, and he just shifts the ball, doesn't he? And then he can whip it into either corner. You know, it was impossible for defenders to get tight to him, because he had the ability with his feet to roll people, and if he did get tight and the ball played in behind, there was no way on earth he was ever going to catch him, even if he gave him 2 or 3 yards. So teams had to defend very, very deep against Arsenal. Not just him, but, you know, your Pireses, your Freddie Lundbergs who'd run in as well. So, and I think that's why Dennis Bergkamp did so well, because Arsenal had so much pace that teams had to drop off, and Bergkamp had so much space to roam around him.
Okay, enough of that. Time for some quick hits. Manchester City rolled to a 3-0 win over Palace with James Milner at centre forward. It's evident, Scowcroft, that playing up front evidently isn't that hard, is it? More seriously, has momentum swung City's game? Bunch of home games coming up.
Exactly. They've got good fixtures coming up, haven't they? Which, the next four fixtures?
Burnley and Sunderland at home, yeah. West Brom away.
You'd expect them to win all four of those, really. And I think all of a sudden there is pressure on Chelsea. I think maybe 6 weeks ago, 2 months ago, I think most people, including myself, thought Chelsea would walk this league. It might not be so easy. I still think they'll win it. But if Man City, and they'll only get better because they've got Aguero and centre-forwards, other people to get back fit, it'll be interesting.
And playing up front is a breeze, even when you're not that fast or not that tall. Yeah,
exactly. He is a very good player for Man City, James Milner. Very underrated.
West Ham win 2-0, and two Englishmen, Stuart Downing and Andy Carroll, steal the show. Alisson, the Hammers just won't go away. should these two be in Roy's plans? Because from what I saw, they were outstanding.
I think Danny can only be in his plans if he plays him the way that Allardyce plays. I mean, he's not going to, because the reason Downing has blossomed is because he's just been given that pivotal playmaker role. He sort of runs the game. He's a very much a confidence player. Allardyce has been amazing this season. Most of what's gone well for West Ham is the way he's nurtured all these players, whether they're new or not, or need to adapt. Anyway, I don't think Hodgson can indulge Downing the way that Allardyce has.
Maybe he
never
should.
Got on to Carroll. Who, yeah, if Carroll's also not got any demons or problems, he's a fantastic player. He should definitely be in the squad.
Spurs overcome Burnley and Eric Lamela opens his Premier League account. Now, normally we would be asking this question of Rory, who's a big Argentinophile. But, James, you were there. Will we remember this as a turning point in Lamela's Premier League career?
Only time will tell that, Gab. But from what I saw at the weekend, he certainly has the ability to become a big star at Spurs. First half especially, I thought it was absolutely sensational. His ball control, I think there was one little run he went to and he went right round the back of Burnley's back four. He crossed it for Harry Kane, who should have scored. But at times, the way he manipulates the ball and receives the ball, absolutely superb. He drifted out the game in the second half, but you can see why Spurs paid the money for him at the weekend.
Southampton break their losing streak by pummeling Everton 3-0 despite numerous absentees. Alison, we're expecting them to sink down the table, but it's happening more slowly than we thought it would. Is it because they're actually very good and Koeman's a very good manager?
Yeah, I didn't expect Southampton to drift too far down the table. Anyway, this was a really important victory. They did it without Schneiderlin, who is their key player, and I think that's great for the whole morale there, that they know they're not too over reliant on him. And also James Ward-Prowse is back from injury. I've been a huge fan of his for ages, and they do have a lovely production line at Southampton, and now we can see that they can slot new players in and they'll rise up the table again.
Manchester United are held 1-1 at Villa Park and Gabby Bonlahor is controversially sent off. James, your thoughts on the red, are actually only give us your thoughts if you think it somehow was a justified red card, because I think you'd have to be a fool to suggest that. But hey, assessed United's sign of progress. Some people feel it might actually have been a backward step.
I think so. I think, I think if we're going to talk about Manchester United being title contenders, which I don't think they are, I think they go to Aston Villa and they win. Especially when they get back to 1-1 and they're playing against 10 men. I think a good team would go on and win that game. United just aren't quite there at the moment.
Did Falcao excite you with his goal?
It's a great goal, and I think if you give him service, I think he will score goals. The problem with Manchester United, although they've got games coming up, they just haven't had the games to play him in and get him fully fit.
QPR go 2 goals down at home to West Brom, and then they unleash Charlie Austin, who bags a hat trick. Alison, we've talked about him before, but you can't help but absolutely adore this man, right?
Right.
Agree with me.
I do agree with you, if you're saying you love him too.
I adore him.
We have a soft spot in this country for players who've come from non-league football or who were rejected when young. He was rejected for being too short. He's over 6 foot. What do academy managers know?
Can we find this guy, just name him and shame him?
I know, it's bad, isn't it?
But excuse me, if I digress here, but if you're going to say, well, Charlie, we don't want you because you're not good enough and you're clumsy and you'll never be, that's one thing. I mean, he's not Eric Lamela. But to look at him and say, like, well, you're too small, and then you look at the size of him now, it's fantastic.
Yeah. Well, that's often what happens. They cull all the time. Some academies, they're culling once a week, every week.
Well, James was telling us at his academy that any 11-year-old who's not as tall as he is isn't admitted. Isn't that right?
That's not right, Gab.
You put them on a growth chart.
They're not culled every week now. They're signed on a 2-year deal. So you have to have them for 2 years. So it'd be 12 to 14, 14
joking,
to 16.
I'm when
explaining
younger,
the rule.
When they're younger,
no,
though.
It's all changed now. I'm not allowed to do this. What used to happen is players like Charlie Austin, et cetera, et cetera, would get at 16, no, we don't think you're physically going to develop this, that, and the other, and still got years to go. So that's why they brought in the under 21s. Now they've got up to 22 to allow players to fully develop. And give them as much time as possible.
I'm curious, were you little as a kid?
No.
So you were always like the big kid who could play?
Yeah.
I've got a question for you, Gab. James has just told me that you've written about Leon in the game this week. I haven't read it yet, so please summarise for those who haven't as well.
Lyon are now second in the table in France. It's a team that you might remember sort of when they won their 7 titles in a row and they were spending and so on. And then they decided to just cut back, stick with kids, focus instead on building a stadium, which will be open for 2016. And the upshot now is they have no fewer than 8 academy products starting for them. The most famous, perhaps, Alexandre Lacazette, who's I think he's got 17 goals and 19 league appearances right now. They have Maxime Gonalons, who's their big captain in midfield. It shows that if you go with youth and you have a plan, then it can work. And it can work if you're sort of that second-tier team trying to knock on the door. And that maybe that's a better approach than going and trying to spend your way to success. Any other business?
Yeah, why didn't we have Christmas jingles as the noise to chivvy us along on the quick hits? That's
why?
An oversight, I would say.
No, because not everybody celebrates Christmas. This is a diverse, multi-ethnic country, and that's why we don't say Christmas, Merry Christmas. We say Happy Holidays. At least I do.
Merry Christmas, Alison.
Merry Christmas, James.
All right. That's all we've got time for this week. If you haven't subscribed on iTunes or Player FM for Android, please do so. Many, many thanks to my guests today, Alison Rudd and James Scowcroft. You can check out thetimes.co.uk on your digital device. Members get exclusive football, rugby, and cricket highlights free as part of your subscription. And if you're not a member yet, don't despair. You can take our £1 digital trial today. All you need to do is search Time Sport online. I won't be here next week, much to the delight of everybody. You'll be in the company of the delightful Mr. Max Rushton, who's actually extremely talented. But I'll see you the week after that in 2015. Bye-bye.
Your subscription to The Times and The Sunday Times now comes with access to every Barclays Premier League goal. Refresh your app, choose your team, accept notification, and you're away.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.